This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's possible that they could agree to simply extend the first phase while they're negotiating the second phase, but getting formal agreement by both parties on exactly what the second phase will look like, I think is pretty tricky.
That was Ellen Lepson, director of the International Security Program at George Mason University, on the challenges of moving on to phase two of the ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. Details coming up also. Rwanda's foreign affairs minister responds to U.S. Treasury sanctions imposed against a Rwandan official. And a high-ranking UN official tells the Security Council that several issues continue to erode Libya's unity and stability. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, a top story. Hamas released the bodies of three Israeli hostages and a fourth unidentified woman Thursday, as phase one of the ceasefire deal with Hamas is set to expire early next month. The United States is pushing the warring parties to move forward with the second phase as Arab nations scramble to find an alternative to President Donald Trump's declaration that he will take over Gaza. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wida-Kuswara has this report.
Four coffins returned by Hamas Thursday contained the remains of Oded Lifshitz, who was 83 when he was abducted, and two young children of the Bibas family. The last, thought to hold the body of their mother Shiri Bibas, held the remains of an unidentified woman, the Israeli military said, accusing Hamas of violating an already tenuous ceasefire. Hamas has not commented. The military said it was a violation of utmost severity by Hamas, adding to Israel's agony following the terror group's October 7, 2023 attack. Dozens of hostages are still in Gaza, including Guy Gilboa Dalal. VOA spoke with his brother Gal.
All we do is for my brother. All we do is to bring him back. All we care about is seeing him again. We miss him so much.
33 hostages were released under phase one of the ceasefire. Their return increased pressure on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to negotiate for the second phase. But far-right members of his coalition want to return to fighting and end Hamas. Pressure also came from Washington. Secretary of State Marco Rubio was in Israel earlier this week, pushing to secure phase two. Analysts say it won't be easy. Ellen Lipson, Director of the International Security Program at George Mason University, via Zoom.
It's possible that they could agree to simply extend the first phase while they're negotiating the second phase, but getting formal agreement by both parties on exactly what the second phase will look like, I think is pretty tricky.
President Donald Trump has repeatedly said he wants to take over the Palestinian territory and rebuild it into the Riviera of the Middle East. On Thursday, National Security Advisor Mike Waltz said Gaza is, quote, a hellhole.
With unexploded ordnance, with debris everywhere, with no sewage, with no water. And President Trump has put forward a plan to deal with the practical reality that is 1.8 million Gazans now truly suffering.
Arab leaders have rejected Trump's plan and are meeting in Riyadh Friday, hosted by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who's helped Trump sought for talks between the U.S. and Russia to end the war in Ukraine. Some analysts say Trump's controversial Gaza demand could be an attempt to shake the status quo. Ahmed Fuad Al-Khatib, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, via Skype.
How successful it has been remains to be seen. Thus far, the only thing we've seen come out of it really is a strong push by Egypt and to a certain extent also by the Saudi government to reconstruct Gaza, leave the Palestinian people there without removing them.
The Egyptian alternative proposal will raise up to $20 billion over 3 years from Arab and Gulf states for Gaza's reconstruction. It excludes Hamas from a Palestinian governance committee in Gaza, which the U.S. designated terror group says it can accept. But it's unclear whether Israel or Trump can.
I haven't seen it. When I see it, I'll let you.
Patsy Wida-Kuswara, VOA News at the White House.
The U.S. Treasury has imposed sanctions on Rwanda's Minister of State for Regional Integration, James Kabariba, for allegedly supporting the M23 rebels in the DRC and benefiting from the DRC's minerals. Speaking with VOA Central Africa Stringer in London, Venuswiti Nshimimana, Rwandan Foreign Affairs Minister Oliver Ndugiri had this response on behalf of the Rwandan government.
This is an unjustified and unfounded decision by the United States government. And we know that these kind of punitive measures cannot contribute towards peace and stability in our region. As for these accusations of minerals, we know who is exploiting minerals in Eastern DRC. It's not Rwanda. There are countries in Africa that exploit minerals that are even intervening in the current conflict. But there are also Western countries that are exploiting DRC minerals. So this accusation cannot hold. You know that there was a joint summit of the EAC and SADC in Dar es Salaam on 8th February, which came up with a pathway for a resolution of the crisis in Eastern DRC. The conclusions of this summit were endorsed by the African Union summit that was held in Addis Ababa last week. So we have a process on the table. And even as we speak, today we have a meeting of the chief of defense staff of the EAC and SADC to start implementing the conclusions of Dar es Salaam. So any decision such as this kind of sanctions are interference, but they are not productive in any case. Because if sanctions could have resolved the conflict in Eastern DRC, we would have had peace in the region for many years ago.
Olivier Jean-Patrick Nduhungirehe, Rwanda's Minister of Foreign Affairs.
The White House says the U.S. is withdrawing from the World Health Organization in part because of concerns it mishandled the investigation of the COVID-19 pandemic that arose out of Wuhan, China, and other global health crises. However, some health officials argue the WHO provides early surveillance of disease outbreaks around the world. VOA's Carol Van Am has more.
President Donald Trump quickly signed an executive order to withdraw the U.S. from the World Health Organization after taking office last month. It will take a year for the process to be complete. Trump had started the same process in 2020 during his first term in office, but former President Joe Biden reversed the action when he moved into the White House. This time around, Trump's efforts are more sweeping, according to Brett Schaefer, senior research fellow at the conservative research institute, the American Enterprise Institute.
The process for withdrawal takes a year, but a lot of the restrictions that he implemented in the executive order will go into place immediately. For instance, having staff that are seconded to the organization come back to the United States and no longer cooperate. U.S. funding presumably will be suspended immediately. So there are a lot of impacts on the organization that will go into place automatically.
In addition to accusing the WHO of mishandling the COVID-19 pandemic, Schaefer says Trump thinks the U.S. is disproportionately burdened by the expenses of the organization. In the WHO budget for fiscal year 2022-2023, the U.S. pledged to give about $1.2 billion, including voluntary contributions to address specific health needs. That was about 15% of the overall budget, and the U.S. is the largest single contributor. Schaefer tells VOA that President Trump has left the door open regarding the WHO.
He said that they want us in, speaking of the WHO and the member governments, they wanted us back so badly, so we'll see what happens. And so presumably, the other member states can entice the United States to return to the WHO if they enact reforms to address his complaints, which are budgetary accountability for China and its role in the initiation of the COVID pandemic, and also to try and improve accountability, transparency, and efficacy of the organization itself.
J. Stephen Morrison is the senior vice president at the Centers for Strategic and International Studies, and he's also director of the Global Health Policy Center there. He tells VOA the WHO provides early surveillance of dangerous outbreaks around the world, including a new outbreak of the Marburg virus in Tanzania.
We have a renewed outbreak of Ebola in eastern Congo, and they have been at the forefront of detecting and reporting that, and they need to be synced up with the United States in communications around this. One of the things that has happened in the most recent executive orders from the Trump administration is a severance of communications between CDC and WHO. Very dangerous. We need to know what is happening in dangerous places that could be coming here to our borders.
Morrison says the WHO also builds capabilities in Africa to prevent disease from spreading.
WHO is very important in building capabilities, workforce and institutional, laboratory and the like. That is done side by side with the CDC, what's called FETP program, which trains emergency responders across Africa. Those are side by side programs, capability building in Africa.
Morrison, however, agrees with Schaefer in thinking that the Trump administration is leaving the door open to rejoining the WHO if certain conditions are met. Carol Van Dam for VOA News, Washington.
A high-ranking UN official told the Security Council Wednesday that entrenched divisions, economic mismanagement, continued human rights violations, and competing domestic and external interests continue to erode Libya's unity and stability. Rosemary DiCarlo, the Under Secretary General for Political and Peacebuilding Affairs, urged Council members to extend their support to newly appointed Special Representative Hanat Hetti in her work to help break the political impasse, resolve Libya's protracted crisis. Wolfgang Postei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed this assessment of the situation in Libya with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
I fully share the pessimistic assessment of DiCarlo. I would even add that the security situation is getting increasingly difficult. This is not only about local armed fighting between the various militias and criminal gangs in western Tripolitania, but this is also about an increasing risk of limited clashes between the forces loyal to the eastern strongman Khalifa Haftar and to the government in the west, especially in the area of the Al-Hamada Al-Hamra desert in southern Tripolitania, where there are some important oil fields located. I would say the main reason for the statement of DiCarlo was, as you said, to rally support for the newly appointed UN Special Representative, Hanat Hetti, and for the current UNSMIL initiative in the face of this deteriorating situation. The problem is that then acting UNSR Stephanie Khoury recently established an advisory committee that shall provide recommendations for resolving outstanding contentious issues about the elections, especially about the election laws. But these laws have already been by and large agreed by Libya's two rival parliaments, the HOR and the HCS. The advisory committee consists of 20 members who were handpicked by Stephanie Khoury. And keeping in mind that Hanat Hetti is just about to take over, I would say that we have now again a new UN Special Representative who is once again tied to a rather dubious initiative of her predecessor, which will significantly limit her own freedom of action. So, in a nutshell, Hetti will certainly need all the support she can get.
The president of the Presidential Council, Mohamed El-Menfi, discussed with the U.S. Special Envoy to Libya, Richard Norland, the efforts of the United Nations mission in Libya and the practical steps taken to advance the political process to end the transitional stages and maintain sustainable stability and head to general elections. How would you compare this to the less optimistic assessment of the Undersecretary General for Political and Peace Building Affairs?
The general perception is that Libya is reasonably stable. But as the UN Undersecretary General has said, this is only on the surface. So Norland recently toured Tripoli, meeting not only PC Chair Al-Menfi, but also Prime Minister Dabeba and several other senior officials, and had a phone call with Aqila Saleh, the chair of the House of Representatives, in order to encourage support to Hanat Hetti, because he is well aware how difficult the situation is right now. And also, and I'm not so sure this is a good idea, to the UNSMIL Advisory Committee initiative. This is similar to what Norland did quite successfully when Tete's predecessor, Abdoulaye Patiyi, took office 2 years ago. Most of his interlocutors certainly agreed with him because they don't seek any real progress. And as I said, the timing of this UN Advisory Committee initiative can be really debated. Delegations of the two rival parliaments will meet next weekend in Cairo to resolve the open issues regarding the elections, the very thing this new advisory committee is about, and to discuss the way ahead towards a new unity government that should replace the current governments in Tripoli, the Dabeba's government, and in Benghazi. I would say maybe it would make more sense for UNSMIL to look into this process before undermining it with an own initiative.
That was Wolfgang Porstai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. We'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. VOA's Anthony Labruto is covering the second day of the annual Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C. today. We have him live by phone. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Anthony.
Thank you, Hayes. It's good to be with you.
So, who's going to be speaking today?
A number of individuals from the Trump administration are expected to speak here throughout the day. With Michael Waltz, the National Security Advisor, just spoke a little while ago. Richard Grenell is the Special Presidential Envoy. He's speaking in about an hour. His role, and he's probably put his upcoming conversation on the U.S. interest of the Ukraine-Russia conflict, will almost certainly be mentioned in that upcoming speech, that upcoming panel. Scott Turner, Housing and Urban Affairs Secretary, just recently confirmed, as was the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Doug Collins. So today is really going to be showcasing the Trump administration's inner workings, those decisions and those decision-making that is going to really impact the American people and allow the attendees at CPAC to really interact with them at a very personal level.
So many of the international CPAC groups are speaking today. What have been some of their highlights so far from them?
A surprising number of CPAC international delegations. For a while here, CPAC was primarily a United States-based group, but there are delegations from Korea, Hungary, Israel, Australia, and Japan. And so they're going to be speaking throughout the afternoon here, but really at the core part of their messaging. And I also had a chance to speak to an African Union representative a little while ago, and he gave us a little bit more of an insight kind of into what the international perspective to this is. And he said that Trump is really, as he put it, a phenomenon that must be exported. His ideals, the energy, the messaging really have resonated, especially in his opinion, with the international community, really elicited a positive response, and he really wants to see that brought elsewhere. And so the same goes for those delegates today. They're expected to really highlight what they want more out of this Trump phenomenon and how they can really bring it to their home countries, really bring an excitement, a positive response to not only kind of the CPAC aligning views, but also somewhat of those Trump views as well. And so certainly possibly even exporting that American version, now that they have President Donald Trump in the White House, seeing that as something that can really be exported to a broader segment of the population.
And Anthony, besides the delegates, you've spoken to a number of attendees. What's been their outlook beyond the conference for conservative priorities?
We really had a chance to get to capture really the cross-section of people that were here. And really, the themes that people have said over and over again is they're excited, they're invigorated for the next 4 years of a Trump administration, in the next 2 years so far that we're predicting of a Republican administration outright in both houses of Congress. So today, too, seeing Trump's cabinet picks in person, asking questions, I see them really, they really like that they're someone that's beyond the television screen. We've been seeing a lot of the confirmation process, on television, but having these people come out and join panels, really mingle amongst the crowd, that's really, really resonating with them. Someone who's not only achieving the goals set out by President Trump's presidential campaign that he was campaigning on for the past couple of years, but really just being able to sit down, have that personal questions answered. And so, like I mentioned yesterday, too, really, this conference is seen as a victory lap and a culmination of the presidential campaign and an outlook of the future of Donald Trump's really transformative presidency is really at the heart of the gathering. It was even said again to me that there really is no CPAC gathering this year without Donald Trump.
VOA's Anthony Labruto covering the second day of the annual Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C. Thank you for your input.
Thank you, Harris.
U.S. small business are waiting to feel the effects of President Donald Trump's executive order imposing a 25% tariff on imported steel and aluminum. Michelle Quinn reports. We'll have that report later on. Right now, we will be going to our sports analyst, Sports Roundup. We have in studio Mokbil Yabaro. Welcome to African News Tonight, Mokbil.
Thanks for having me, Hayes.
So, in Major League Soccer news, Messi scores his first goal in 2025 in minus 20 degrees weather. Is he still one of the best football players in the world?
I think he definitely is arguably one of the greatest of all time. Currently in his career right now, he is on his back leg, similar to the likes of Cristiano Ronaldo playing in their later years. But this is somewhat of a first for him. Historically, Messi normally doesn't play in cold weather. This is not a thing that he does. Even as far as some of his former teammates would say, if the weather is too cold, Messi might not be playing today. Hmm. This is not what he's used to. South America, obviously, we know is relatively warm. In Europe, it doesn't really get as cold either, but this was something that he had not experienced before. He came out with a neck warmer, looked like a turtleneck, gloves. If he could, he would be wearing a jacket, but he came out and played relatively well for his team. So, yeah, shout out to Messi for doing something that he normally wouldn't.
Scoring in a minus 20 degree weather. So, staying with football, the Champions League and Europa League has some exciting matches. What were some of the results?
Yeah, definitely. I would say that the Real Madrid versus Man City match at the Bernabeu, which is Real Madrid's home field, was the one to watch. Kylian Mbappe has arrived, as they're saying, in Real Madrid with a hat trick against Manchester City that now allowed them to make it to the round of 16 in the Champions League. They kind of started off really slow in the Champions League, really trying to get their footing, figuring things out. But now they really look like they're clicking, and they will be going up against their La Liga. I wouldn't say rivals, but this is a team that's third place in La Liga right now, Atletico Madrid. So they do have that little bit of a La Liga rivalry there, and they will be facing them in the next round. Another game that was really, really big was PSG versus Brest. PSG put up 7-0, and they scored 3 in the first matchup when they met as well. So that's a 10-0 aggregate in Champions League. Insane, insane. And then if we're just going to quickly look at Europa, I think a Real Sociedad's 5-2 win against Midtjylland was a huge one, as well as Galatasaray, 2-2 tie, but they still lost 6-3 on aggregate.
And moving to basketball, Mokbil, in the NBA, the Lakers get a thrilling win against the Trail Blazers, and LeBron scores 40 again at 40 years old. Is he the greatest ever?
This is another one that definitely is in the conversation. I believe folks will kind of just say it's either between him and Michael Jordan. I think the nostalgia of what Michael brought to the game and allowing the game to globalize really kind of gives him that little bit of an edge, as well as the Jordan sneakers, kind of puts them over the top. But definitely LeBron has played better than Michael Jordan in this later part of their career. So 40 points at 40 doesn't look like he's slowing down. I definitely think that this is something to really watch. I don't think it'll be duplicated.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Thank you, Mokbil. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Douglas Impuga, and our engineer, Saida Hamdoun, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.